Hello, everybody. Welcome. My name is Dee Slavutin, and you are at the East Hampton Poetry Marathon, its 25th year. And I took over the curating of this program about 4 years ago from two women who were nonagenarians when they stepped down. We have two wonderful poets today. Tom Thompson will be our first reader, and Carol Stone will be our second reader. Joan Cusack Handler was not able to make it. So our first reader is Tom Thompson. First, I'll give you a formal introduction and then some impressions of his work, my impressions, of course. So Tom Thompson is the author of Live Feed and The Pitch and Passenger, three books that he has published. He has degrees from Dartmouth College, University of Sussex, UK. Oh, now I know where he met his lovely wife. And the University of Iowa. His poems, essays, and reviews have appeared widely. A longtime advertising executive, he currently works at St. Martin's Press and lives in New York City with his family. He has two sons. So reading Tom's work, I would say it's a challenge to the intellect to get the grounding that is needed in order to get into the poetry. And one of my friends that says to me that I'm lazy because I don't like looking in the dictionary when I'm reading a poem. I think I should be able to, you know, be able to read the poem and understand it. And then there's a poem that Tom wrote that he'll be reading for us, which had a title that I couldn't make any sense out of, but I just skipped that. Hello, don't skip your titles, okay? The title is called Interictal. And I read the poem several times, and So I said, I'm going to look up this word, if it's a word. And sure enough, it's a word. And then it puts the whole poem in perspective. And the word is, interictal, is of or relating to an interval between convulsions or seizures. It's a very serious poem. It took on a whole different meaning once I understood what he was writing about. And one line in the poem, Tom gives us a glimpse into what he called, quote, a disturbance of the animal functions of the soul. There was another word in that poem, Episcopalian canticles. Now, I understood Episcopalian, but canticles, I knew song, canticles, song. I had to look up canticles. And it's one of the non-metrical hymns or chants from the Bible. And I thought that was so interesting because that also created a way into understanding Tom's poetry, non-metrical. Then there's another poem called Sensible and True. And this one I really relished because it's about choice and how we use our time. And there's a line in there that I will personally rely on many times over. And the line says this, there are at least as many states of rest as there are human enterprises. It's time to choose words again, even if it's just a path toward the exit. So, and I think the context here was somebody had, was confronting him with how, well, are you using your time? Are you wasting your time? How is your time being used? Is it productive time? And I like there are at least as many states of rest. But I will say to you, be prepared for the enigmatic images and titles of his poetry, turning as a kind of shouting. Now, maybe Tom, as you said, he would read it, so maybe he'll explain it to us before he reads it. So turning as a way of shouting. Okay. So with no further ado, please let's ask the real McCoy, Tom Thompson, to come and share his poetry with us. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Dee. Thank you for that wonderful introduction and for the invitation to this beautiful, beautiful space. for me a chance to get outside of Manhattan when I could really use it. And this beautiful air and this wonderful light. Really very happy to be here and very grateful that you're all here too. It's funny, my job at St. Martin's Press, one description of it might be something like, tell people what books are about. Describe a book to a person so they might know if they want to read it. But when people ask me what my book's about, I get very reticent. And it's very difficult for me to talk about what the book's about. So I hope I'm going to be a little bit of help, but I'm not sure how much help, because it's the poems for me are very working lyrically around a circumstance or a problem or maybe even a kind of language. But I will tell you something about the poems in this book, and that they're really clustered around three inciting incidents, maybe. One is when my son was diagnosed with absence epilepsy. Another is when my older brother, who was the most athletic and vigorous among us, had a stroke at 52. It was a real shock. And the third, there was a year when several people, including my sister-in-law, died, and who I was very close to. So those encounters with the body and the spirit and consciousness are resonant throughout these poems. And they're all kind of, they're inciting incidents, I would say. This first poem in particular, when my brother was in ICU, he was in ICU for over a month. It was a very serious stroke. And he would come, the thing is when you're in ICU, he would be unconscious in this deep, dark, but the most private space you could possibly be in. And then he would emerge from into consciousness. But where are you? You're suddenly in this very, very public space. It's bright. There are lights. There are people you don't know. You don't quite know where you are. Suddenly, you've gone from the most private space imaginable to the most public space. And I was trying to imagine what that might be like. There's a line in this poem from Saint Teresa of Avila. So this, she is a person who was seized by God, and whether it was an actual seizure or she was seized by God, I don't know. But she, when she talked of it, she said, "I could not wish to be rid of it." So she did not choose the ecstatic moment. The ecstatic moment seized her. It was violent. The body in the bed. First, there were whispers, then a fizzing behind my eyes, a tongue of light, a fit of flame, a spidering sound like rain smattering a tarp, or a lit cigarette doused in a sink. There was a pointed series of breaths when I came to, and shaking. I was shaking, disquiet. I was possessed. No, I was shot through with garnet, like molasses, slow, like meat. I could not wish to be rid of it. There were rubber socks and quarter-inch bands that dictated blood flow until I became a pillar of hellfire, torqued about by a gown of love. I was waking and static and swaddled in sweat. Adoration was my trainer, and I was its flunky. Either way, there was work to be done, and I was the one having it done to me. This next poem is interictal, which I usually have to describe what that word is, but you've already done, which is fantastic. So it's the moment between seizures. We often think about the seizure as the moment you focus on, but in cases like my son's, when the seizures were quite frequent, you really do pay attention to the space between the seizures too. In a way, there's also, for my son, an absence fit. One of the things about them is that they're hard to tell. They're not like a grand mal seizure. You stop, and then you emerge. So it took us a while to understand that he had epilepsy. We just thought he was kind of a spacey kid, but he had epilepsy. That phrase that you quoted, a disturbance of the animal functions of the soul, is actually a definition of the word disorder, as in medical disorder, that I found in one of my favorite dictionaries, a 19th century version of the Webster's Dictionary. Interictal. First, the smell of burnt wire. Then, eggy sweat. You come to, and it's Episcopalian canticles rising up the air shaft. It's Sunday. There's the scent of fish tacos. Small dogs press their lips to living room glass. Light shivers like a cell. Some call this a disturbance of the animal functions of the soul. You know it as fatigue. How time sometimes gets out in front of you. Once they'd have shouted holy, holy at your head, or drowned you for a witch. It's hard to breathe. Ethereal prick you'd call out if your mouth could move. This material substance rings with it, what you can't say. Earth floats in the window pane, a pendulous fruit that's consumed its tree. Is it the oxygen blend streaming through your head like a helmet? Or is it just you riding empty swells for 5 or 15 seconds until the bell of everything else goes under the sea green? So one of the things I'm thinking about is the way epilepsy in other cultures and in other times was often seen as somebody who might have a connection with the gods. They might be seized by God. Now, of course, we medicalize it, and thank goodness. That's a good thing. But I'm interested in that connection between this event and the spirit. This next poem, the surgeons I've met in medical capacities have all been incredible people, super capable, very confident. I met in a different context a surgeon in a meditation group. And so I got to know him outside of the hospital just as a guy. And he was a very interesting, tender, self-questioning person. And it surprised me that he was a surgeon and an accomplished surgeon. This is thinking about him and about the different spaces in a hospital. Surgeon, you're patient, but rattled. Vertical in your swimming pool blue clothes. The body under your thumb is rim to rim, one shallow piece of skin. An alien, quivering tambourine, you slip your hand inside. Out in the family courtyard, we drift, dull as bees in heavy oxygen. The air between us, an open, riotous sea. A chime could cross it, this chasm between us. It fills with the ring sometimes of a climber's shiny dropped instrument. Another poem about emerging into consciousness. The orderlies. One white figure stands at the screen, gathers others. They cluster around my machine, as gulls cluster and gather at a cliff. Who says I exist? Ice stumbles, falls in the icebox down the hall. Locks rattle, visiting room doors. I hear them all. I don't move. Not even for flies, those precise delegates that will not let my blood be. Strike that, one says. So what, the other. Fuck you, a laugh. For drinks. Light draws the eye to boxes, piled on boxes, little refineries of memory that blink on and off, analyzing my protein counts in lemon and lime. Articulating this human matter as chemical shift. Pure information. No story. No communicable word. The room's pristine architecture is openly violated by their laughter. Whose violation? Who's the stranger here? Am I the rigorous prototype? On what planet are we bathed in bacterial light? This next poem is called Breath on the Mirror, and a breath on the mirror, of course, is a test for whether you're living, right? See, is there breath? We believe that time has no color, no odor, and that respiration occurs without color or odor. Still, we observe the event as a luster on skin, a familiar off-plum scent. The infection grows rampant, feeds on itself in this compromised respiratory tract. It takes the name of our nature. It makes arrangements. Together, we record the dilation of pupils, register the alteration of oral bacterial flora. The agent needs oxygen if it's to breathe as we do. We're coating our mirrors with glue. It's when you live in Manhattan, you have this sort of fantasy that if you could just go to a quiet place, you might get a good night's sleep. And then you go to a quiet place like East Hampton, or we had a house upstate for a while. And of course you hear the bugs, the wind, you know, the window rattles, all of a sudden the house creaks, you know, you hear all the other noises. So this is something like Ode to a Bad Night's Sleep. And it's called Turning as a Kind of Shouting. Is it total night or absolute morning? The bed, a ragged, tumbling thing. You're just trying to keep still in it. Cicadas nuzzle each other in the trench out back. This is what you said you wanted. It's dead quiet. And yet, the window rattles its tracks, rattles birds who mistake it for air. There's a smudge on the glass you take for a ghost, a dream you can't shake enough to exit. One truck chugs opalescent exhaust in through the window. It makes a mineral cloud that seeds a fern in your lungs, cracks open the eyes to a speckled dark where you wake, humid now, as it is inside the hold of a ship. This is a poem thinking about, you know, those clumps of seaweed that you see in the water, and they have that, they have this incredible density to them, a kind of a sublime density to them. So this is thinking about that. It's a body, face down in swells, floating and dragging in time. Rust-red organisms cleave to it. It is a silent climate. Floor to some and ceiling to others, both dense and luxe. It's breathing, just breathing. This dark forest in salt fluid emits a continuous low pitch crinkling of concern, such as adults emit as they adjust their not yets and nocturnal whispers to children to hush. All we have are the starched psychic instruments of our good clothes. What else can we do with these near-human amplitudes that pulse the bay? There is an echo in our voice, and in our air, and in our water, and in our earth, and you, at the mouth, strange species, The sea is animal, vegetable, and mineral. It seizes and holds us fast where the eyes go. And this last poem is thinking about my sister-in-law, who I lost. And I don't believe in ghosts, but I had this experience sitting in my writing room, feeling like she was there. I felt a physical presence. And this is thinking about that. The title, Sensible and True, actually comes from something that Horatio says in Hamlet. So Horatio's the most sensible person in Hamlet by a mile. Like, it's not even close. And he sees the ghost of old Hamlet, and he says, ghost. I wouldn't believe it was so if it were not for the sensible and true avouch of my own eyes. Sensible and true. Mornings, the mist is a breathing thing. She greets me, all Viking smile and gardener's hands, battered blue and gold. Does it matter that she died half a year ago? Or that even dead, she's kept her talent for pissing me off with that look that says, is this what you should really be doing with your day? The consequences of wasted time are only more of an open question now, with her half here, half vanished, in the half light of dawn. 'Tis here, 'tis here, and 'tis gone. How in all this do I make or find an equilibrium to call my own? There are at least as many states of rest as there are human enterprises. For me, the work is to choose words again, to make some way, even if it's just the way to the exit. Each choice I make looks like folly from where she sits. I choose to give words to air, and again to air, believing as I do that air is all there is. Since when did all this choose your own adventure become your only end? My sister, who could offer some insight into this, stays zip-lipped at the foot of the bed, in a way that's both comforting and unsettling. I think maybe she's not sure she's really here. We each have a belief that's path-dependent. Mine says she exists. Hers, she doesn't. Listen. Our present circumstances depend not just on where we are, but how we got here. The departments of housing, sex, sleep, even dying. Now 11 flights up at my desk. Here I am talking to you. And a bee appears in the window box, 11 flights up. It's a mirror. That's what I mean. It says, take what you need, brother. Pass it along. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. It all suddenly makes a lot more sense to me. You know, you're reading there's a lot about breath and air, and your reading brings the breath and air into the poetry. So it was just beautiful. Thank you very much. And this question of existence and purpose and your pursuit of poetry, it's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, our next poet, Carol Stone, who many of you doesn't need any introduction, because Carol is known so well, and she brings a very unique talent to us. First, I'll read you her formal introduction and then some impressions. Distinguished professor of English and creative writing, Emerita, Montclair State University, Carol Stone's poetry includes, her collections include Hurt the Shadow, Dos Madres Press, American Rhapsody, Cabin Carry Press, Traveling with the Dead, Backwaters Press, and All We Have Is Our Voice, Dos Madres Press. Her work has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize. She has received 3 fellowships from the New Jersey State Council on the Arts. Her poems have appeared most recently in Blue Fifth Review, Chet, A Journal of Medicine, Pen and Brush, The Bellevue Literary Review. She divides her time between Springs, Lucky Us, in East Hampton, and Verona, New Jersey. Now, I'm also lucky enough to be in a Monday evening workshops in the summertime where Carol is with us. And what is so remarkable about her skill set is that every poem tells us a little story, or it could be a big story, but there's no question there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. So for Carol, the narrative is incredibly explicit, and it helps us as readers to understand her poetry. Now, what I thought was so interesting, she started out with Hurt the Shadow, and she continued it, and she'll be reading from this book. It's her newest book. It's called All We Have Is Our Voice. Carol inserted herself in this one, Hurt the Shadow, the Josephine Hopper poems. She imagined that she was Josephine Hopper, and every poem is written from being Josephine Hopper. So this idea must have caught in flame with her, because in this one, All We Have Is Our Voices, is our voice. She's expanded her, what I would call, infusion of herself into many people. And what she has done here, she speaks in the voice of many wives, including Tolstoy's wife, Paul Klee's wife, Frau Freud, Caitlin Dillon, First Lady Mary Todd Lincoln. So it's quite astonishing what she has done. And also, to her credit, almost all of these poems have appeared elsewhere, which means she's, you know, highly publishable, including The West of Ireland, that's where it was published, and in Paris Etude, because she's taken on the persona of these, you know, foreign women as well. And then one more thing to comment about her. One of the critics said, you know, she's talks about the ekphrastic, another word I had to look up. Okay, so it is a vivid description of a scene or a painting through the imaginative act of narrating and reflecting on the action of a painting or sculpture. So just to give you 2 examples, Carol will give you many of her own, but it's often, you know, if a poet wants inspiration, they can look at a painting and then try to create a poem about that painting, and it's called ekphrastic poetry. So here's, Carol, forgive me, if you were going to read this, please do, but here's just 2 that I wanted to just point out for this imagery that she creates. It's so vivid. This is Frau Freud. I set out the Bavarian night china and wait on my husband at table. He worries about our oldest son, who has bronchitis again, and on and on. And one more example of this. Oh, I love this one. This is Georgia O'Keeffe. Now, we all know Georgia O'Keeffe and the big skull, right? So now, in this poem, this is Georgia O'Keeffe. I gaze at my painting of the cow's skull, a gleaming bone in the desert, unmarked grave. So that's just a little tastelet of what's to come. Carol, if we could welcome you, please. Thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Dee. I'm a poet who's torn between the personal and the non-personal. So in the books that Dee was describing, they are, as she said, And then in other books, it's all about me. I'm sorry that Joan Cusack Handler was unable to be here tonight. And she, as many of you may know, is the publisher of Cavan Curry Press, and she published my book. So I thought, thinking about her, that I would read some poems from this book first. This book is called American Rhapsody, and it's largely about Prohibition, the death of my parents at that time, and the racketeering father, who I didn't know very much about, and I guess you'll get some of that as I read the poems. By the light of the silvery moon, the Chickering piano, the best that rum-running money could buy, carved legs, hand-painted roses on a yellow background, half-covered by a flower-fringed shawl, my father bought so my mother could pass the evenings alone. War over, stock market up, in a speakeasy, high rollers hoisted glasses of single malt, $10 a shot, a month's rent, making whoopee. Piano that holds the photograph of my parents sitting close, that no one plays, that I sat beneath. I want to spoon, learning to tie my shoelaces, listening to the grown-ups who never spoke my father's name. The stranger in the photo of my parents. You look happy, your glass is full. Why are you there between my parents and Sloppy Joe's bar in Havana? My father's associate, partner in rum running, an IRS man tracking cash that went to Batista, a member of a rival clan, making sure you got your cut, just a salesman on vacation at Cuba's Varadero Beach. I snipped you out of my copy. I don't know your name. Your secrets are buried in Havana, in a bar, in Cuba, mi amor. Incantation. And the epigraph is by, actually, he's a very famous Hungarian poet, but we don't know who he is because we don't read too many European poets. His name is Resto Sarres. Little white flowers will never awaken you. Sometimes I feel I could speak a lost language, the way as a girl in department stores, I would trail two chatting women through lingerie, eavesdropping on their Hungarian, as if those sounds, dimly remembered like an incantation, would make my mother appear. And sometimes syllables bubble from my weeping mouth like water, making first helpless utterances that call forth a mother's love. Let's see. I wanted to read one more from this book. This, in contrast to what Dee has just said, is a more abstract poem. So I'll read that as the last one from this particular book. Home Ceremonies. Overnight, forsythia by the roadside, by the hillside, beneath the underpass, Bach on the radio, nisht, nisht, hazu, hazu, rattles rooftops. Betrayal in the garden. How quickly the yellow will vanish, as if it had never come. Who are we when we speak the bone, when we dig in the sky? Who are we when we bow to nothing? No, not anyone. Yet moon hanging and oh, stars. What she wants is to wade knee-deep in tenderness, to swim in that river, her dearest ones holding her. She gathers yellow flowers for the ceremony, which could be emptiness, which could be wholeness. So that is American Rhapsody. All we have is our voice, as has, again, Dee has explained, is in the voice of other people, and I've tried to project myself into them. I chose a few poems that I didn't read at Amagansett Library so that you might get a sense of who else I have written about. And the first one I'm going to read is called Widow, and it's about Gustav Mahler's wife. Do you know who Gustav Mahler's wife was? Well, you don't have to know, but maybe you'll know when I finish reading the poem. She only married famous men. That was her thing. Widow, Gustav Mahler. In Vienna, where the coffee houses mixed schlag with hate, Gustav let himself be baptized to be conductor of the court opera. He would have time to compose, time to take café 40 years before people would be dragged away. When we married, he made me give up performing my music. Walter Gropius. Walter built beautiful buildings. My gift to him was our two children. What is Bauhaus architecture compared to their lives? He never forgave me for going back to Gustav's bed when he lay dying. Franz Werfel. Franz, with whom I fled Europe for America, will always be remembered for Song of Bernadette. I inspired his words on the page. Years younger than me, he was my last genius. Tonight at the Hollywood Bowl, a flute begins its tremolo. Kettle drums bang like the tread of leather. The conductor lifts his baton like an officer's saber. Gustav's leader on my lips, I, Alma Mahler, Gropius, Werfel, famous widow, sit in the first row. The strange thing was, a few nights ago, Song of Bernadette was on Channel 13, and, you know, his name was there and everything, and it was just so interesting to see it in light of my having written that poem. This is Dylan Thomas's wife, Caitlin, who stayed back there in Wales while he was giving all of these readings on campus, drinking and making merry with the ladies. And the epigraph is, in fact, by Dylan Thomas. The oat was merry in the wind. I rush along Hudson Street to the White Horse Tavern, a wife who jostles strangers at the bar to be near her husband, who is ordering Macallan Scotch in a voice deep as a cathedral's bell. Women surround him, as they do after his readings. Dylan, fame burst over you. I want you back in Swansea. I miss our pillow talk. Poetry's no substitute for love. Oops. Who else have I got here? Oh, this is one I haven't read. Kafka's Final Hours. In the text of the poem, you will be hearing quotes from Kafka's story, The Country Doctor. All my life, I craved art. With every woman, I hesitated. Dying, I found my great love. The country doctor's horses turned their big heads north, hauling his carriage all the starry night. Father, in my letter, I accuse you of leaving my stories unread. A life stuffed into his black bag, sentenced to ride forever, the physician cracked. Like Gregor Samsa, turned into a cockroach, creeping close to the border, playing his violin. In these final hours, each time I spit up bright blood, his leather whip shouted, faster, faster, to his two exhausted brown mares. I hear the winds calling me. A false alarm on the night bell once answered, it cannot be made good, not ever. I think with my stories, I'll outwit death. And of course, he died of tuberculosis at a young age. I read a poem about the Russian poet Bella Akhmadulina last time that I read. And right across the page, we have Irina Ratushkinskaya. She is not as well known, but she had a short spate of celebrity or publicity because she was imprisoned in Russia and she came to this country and knew freedom, but people don't know her as well as they know Akhmadulina. Irina Ratushkinskaya in prison. With a matchstick, I scratch my poems on soap, memorize them, wash them away, stand at attention in a cold cell, address a uniformed woman as citizen superintendent. All night I listened to women prisoners cry, "Mama, remember the telegram ordering my arrest. You will dream of me, Russia. One day my poems will flow from my mouth like tea from the samovar." Marc Chagall's I and the Village, 1911. That is an ekphrastic poem. Just to... My father, flail on his shoulder, walks uphill toward my mother. Her hands outstretched, she dances up and down. A woman inside a cow milks it. I add a blue sky and a goose down cloud. Then a church, cross on top, its organ silent as my prayers. And a necklace around the neck of a big green face. His fingernailed hand holds a grape cluster, as if I could hold back the annihilation to come with my painting. I keep Vibetsk in my heart. And of course, that's the village he came from in Russia that he never forgot about and was always painting in. Painting after painting. Well, I think I'll end this book with a poem that is based on a generic male poet. So all male poets in the house who think this is you, you are welcome to put yourself inside the poem. Celebrated. What would it be like to be the celebrated poet pacing before the audience, ranting against hierarchy, gulping water from a pitcher, spitting and screaming against extremism, grimacing and interrupting himself, foaming against the right wing? What would it be like to be ferociously pursued by women and face twisting, jaw working, to always be in love, to sing a little tune, dance a few steps before each poem, one hand raised, waving each simple gesture, a celebration and a mourning? What would it be like after the reading, shaken by euphoria, to autograph each book, much love and devotion? What happens alone in a borrowed apartment, telephone calls to a childhood friend in Chicago, an ex-lover in Charlottesville, a 90-year-old mother in Miami? Is there Thai takeout? Do the hours drag? Does the doorbell ring? Is there regret in the middle of the night, thinking of the divorces, the years of wandering, the neglected students, the dust covering the velour sofa? Now, that is based on an actual poet, so anyone who wishes to come after and tell me who you think it is most welcome to do so. I'll just read maybe one or two poems from this. These are all based on Edward Hopper's painting, but Joe is speaking. However, her art is not very well known. In fact, I could say literally people don't know that Josephine Hopper was a painter. So instead of reading the ones based on Hopper's paintings, I am going to read the ones, a few, based on Joe Hopper's. Campground in the Battle of Washington Square, 1947. Hearth in the middle, my teapot and plates. I know what you're thinking, feminine. Fussy, no wonder, Ed's the great artist. Look again, you see a life, I almost said wife, needing a touch of sentiment. He thinks I could only do flowers. I'll give him flowers, gentians, poppies. I fill my studio with them. Edward Hopper reading Frost, and the epigraph is Robert Frost. In one of his less uplifting poems about a not-so-good marriage, which I take was his own. She strayed so far she scarcely heard when he called her and didn't answer, didn't speak, or return. At home in his undershirt, old pants and slippers, skinny arms, thick eyebrows, my husband looks like any other old man. He lets on to be humble. He is not. I've never wanted to emulate him. My sheer white curtains undulate. I'd have him read Frost's Desert Places. And the last one from this book, Judson Tower, Washington Square South, 1950. The Arc de Triomphe look-alike in the park reminds my husband of Paris, where I have never been. See his empty Washington Square as if without people he'd never get hurt. See my double-decker bus, it's filled with tourists. So why are his black-windowed buildings and his fountains without water remembered? Not, this is an after-my-death question, my bare winter tree, my wrought iron fire escape from which I could climb straight down. So I guess she's talking it to him, so to speak, or at least I tried to do something like that. And I think now just to, I always like to read one or two new poems at the end, because then if I see you nodding or if I see you whatever, then I'll know, back to the drawing board. Hugs and kisses. The French kiss you on each cheek. Eskimos rub noses. The English peck lightly. Latinos crush you with an abrazo. Hungarian men click their heels and kiss your hand. Snobs blow a kiss into the air as if it could be caught. Mothers cuddle their babies, whisper, cutie pie. In my family, no one kissed, no one hugged, no one called me dearest, no one said, love you, before hanging up the phone. Arms around my body, I hugged myself, stroked my forehead, whispered, baby, sweetie, darling. No one says necking anymore. No one says they went all the way. In his parked car, Ted put his hands on my breasts. I let him kiss my shoulders. We do this for hours until we got tired. Okay, let's see what else have I got. Last time I read a poem about Frida Kahlo, which was kind of grisly because she was very ill at that point in her life. So here's another Frida Kahlo poem. Like many others, I am an aficionado. I mean, you know, she's everywhere. Frida Kahlo's eyes. At the Mercado, your self-portrait with parrots adorns shopping bags. On restaurants, ladies' rooms, doors, your eyebrows grow thicker each year. Camellias at your throat, you stare from postcards, your hair entangled in a headdress of leaves. From a 10-peso note, you and Diego smile. In a ruffled wedding dress, monkeys on your shoulders, your red mouth cries out, your eyes weep. You've become a patron saint, like the Virgin of Guadalupe. Poor women pray to you for health, for money, for a good man. And this is another poem about Mexico, where my husband and I spend, hopefully next year as well, 5 weeks each winter, looking for a cure. A pelican dives into the bay. Vendors hawk popsicles. Women clay masks from baskets on their heads. Noon, they rest under palm trees, umbrellas of the poor. Overhead, a flock of gulls flap their way north, returning to their first nesting place. How can I find mine? Father embalmed in whiskey, mother shrouded in a silver sheath. Not in the sky, on land, or in the sea. They are the ache that lives in me. No tin milagro a woman offers can cure. It's January 6th, and the three kings are following the star to bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh for the infant. Soon shattered pinatas will release their gifts. Mine, I am alive. That was just published in a Catholic journal, and then a Catholic anthology wants to publish it too. I didn't think it was a Catholic poem, but what do I know? So it's all in who reads it, right? And I'll finish with this last poem, which will show you where I stand on religion, The Buddha. When I pause in front of his golden likeness in my garden, I feel he understands my anger, my wounds. His right hand holds a begging bowl. His left hand is raised with patience. He helps me to hold on to the things I love. Heron standing on one foot in bay water, bike wheels, straw basket, curb of Siwatanejo's Bay, Dublin pubs, the Jersey shore where the Atlantic held me. No organ, no sermon for this woman who holds absence in her heart, a small god. The Buddha looks at me as if he knows who I am. Thank you.